Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 29, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the KBR versus U.S. case decided earlier this week by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today two experts, Marcia G. Madsen. She's a partner at Mayer Brown here in Washington, D.C. She'll be joined by Christopher A. Bowen. He is an associate at Arent Fox, also right here in Washington, D.C. We're going to get opening remarks from each in turn of about 10 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to you for questions, so please be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the call. But for now, let's turn to opening remarks. Ms. Madsen, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Dean. Good afternoon, everyone. Chris and I are delighted, actually, to be able to talk about the Supreme Court's decision earlier this week in Kellogg Brown and Root Services versus Carter. It's a False Claims Act case, and a topic that, and at least to my recollection, is not typically or frequently discussed at the Federalist Society, but one in which I think both Chris and I think the Federalist Society should have a great deal of interest. In the KBR versus Carter case, Carter was actually a QI-TAM relator who had filed a case involving KBR's participation in I think water purification activities in Iraq during the Iraq War, and he claimed that essentially KBR had overbilled the government or billed the government for activities that had not occurred, and so he was filing under the False Claims Act in an attempt to recover the bounty that relators are entitled to under that statute, which led to a very long sequence of events that we're going to be talking about today. In its decision earlier this week, the Supreme Court reversed a decision of the Fourth Circuit, which had applied the Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act, which I'm sure we will revert to the WSLA as a shorthand form as we talk here today. They applied the WSLA to extend the limitations period that's applicable to claims in a False Claims Act action. The WSLA extends the statute of limitations. And there was some concern, particularly among defendants, government contractors who are Chris's clients and my clients, that it had effectively been extended indefinitely by use of the WSLA. There are several other circuits that had also ruled similarly to the Fourth Circuit, and the effect on defendants is to subject them to substantial FCA liabilities on stale claims that are getting older and older the longer the statute is extended. So the first part of our discussion today is going to be about the court's ruling on the WSLA, where it held that it was not applicable to civil False Claims Act cases. And then the second part of our discussion is going to be about one of the jurisdictional bars in the False Claims Act, the first to file bar. I'm going to talk briefly about the WSLA. And I think from the perspective of the defense bar, the decision was an important victory for government contractors, as well as other businesses, which principally could include healthcare companies, but also anyone who does business with the federal government in any capacity, so grantees, people who participate in other types of federal programs where there's at least a potential financial benefit. So it's an important decision to all of those categories of federal program participants. I want to just talk for a moment about what the Civil False Claims Act is. I think probably many people are familiar with it. Some may not be. It's an old statute. It was enacted during the Civil War. It was substantially amended in 1986. The things that make it unique as a government enforcement tool are its low intent requirement, the knowing standard. This is a civil fraud statute, so the knowing standard is not criminal intent. It's much less than that. It's basically reckless disregard or acting in deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsity of information that a party possesses. So it's not a difficult proof burden for a relator or for the government, and it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. The statute allows for treble damages plus penalties plus interest and attorney's fees in cases that are fully litigated. With respect to the statute of limitations, the statute provides that it's no more than 6 years after the violation or 3 years after the date when the facts are known or should have been known, but in any event, no more than 10 years after the violation was committed. The Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act could extend that 10-year period for a much longer time, and as I said earlier, some defendants have been concerned that given the wartime footing that the United States has been on since 2001, it could be a very long time, you know, potentially indefinite, at least from a corporate perspective. The Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act was originally enacted shortly after World War I. It was intended to apply to wartime fraud problems. It was then reenacted during World War II. Until 2008, the WSLA permitted the statute of limitations to be suspended during wartime and for 3 years after the end of hostilities. Congress expanded the WSLA in 2008 to apply when Congress enacts specific authorization for the use of armed forces, and in 2008 it also increased the suspension period to 5 years after the termination of hostilities. And the timing, you can see, could be potentially long, and we're going to talk in a minute about how the statute gets triggered. There's been some debate about that the Supreme Court didn't resolve. During the last several years, relators, key TAM relators, have argued that the False Claims Act statute of limitations was suspended under the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm going to talk, I think, separately in a second about an interesting discussion in the Fourth Circuit's opinion regarding what constitutes war for purposes of the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act, but that's a little bit of a detour, so I'll come back to that. The argument that has been made for the statute of limitations suspension has been made not only in cases that involve, like KBR did, activities in a conflict zone, but also in cases that don't have anything to do with military contracts. In healthcare cases, in cases involving civilian agencies, there's a case probably in 2012, U.S. versus BNP Paribas, which is a case involving a Department of Agriculture credit guarantee program. The Wartime Statute of Limitations was used to extend the statute there. So the WSLA has the potential to dramatically expand the reach of the False Claims Act and require companies, government contractors among them, to litigate claims that are very, very old, with the result that companies frequently do not have the evidence, the witnesses, the material they need to defend themselves. And the cases can, the older they get, the more expensive they can get. The Supreme Court in KBR versus Carter resolved the question of the application of the Wartime Statute of Limitations on the basis of statutory language. There was a debate in the case, and one of the reasons it made it to the Supreme Court in the first place was an argument between the defense bar, the Department of Justice, and the relators bar about whether the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act suspended the statute of limitations in civil cases or only in criminal cases. And the Supreme Court said, in resolving it, of course they always make it sound easy, right? You wonder how the case got there. But the Supreme Court said that the WSLA suspension of the statute of limitations applies to the running of any statute of limitations that's applicable to an offense involving fraud or attempted fraud against the United States or any agency thereof. And the Supreme Court went on to analyze that language as offense being in the criminal context. It was relevant to the court that the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act is in Title 18 as opposed to anywhere else, and although the court noted that you know, that's not dispositive. It's an indication of what Congress had intended. The court went on to explain that when it was first enacted in 1921, the Wartime Statutes of Limitations Act applied to offenses involving defrauding or attempts to defraud the government that are, and this phrase turns out to be important, quote, now indictable under any existing statutes, close quote. The WSLA was amended in 1944, toward the end of World War II, to delete the phrase now indictable under any statute, and it also suspended the limitations period for 3 years after the cessation of hostilities was proclaimed. For several years now, the Department of Justice and relators have argued repeatedly that the 1944 removal of the now indictable language expanded the application of the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act to civil claims, and it's been used pretty aggressively to bring very old cases. So it's been a bone of contention for the defense community. In KBR, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected this argument as, quote, most improbable. It's Justice Alito's opinion, and he's quite pointed about his views. He says, you know, he explains why he thinks it's most improbable. He indicated that deleting the now indictable language but leaving the word offense is simply, in his view, too obscure to substantially expand the reach of the WSLA. And he pointed out again in his view that fundamental changes in a statute typically aren't that subtle. If Congress intends to do something that would radically change the reach of statutes that's as important as changing the statute of limitations, they would typically be clear so that everybody knows what they've done. Companies know what they've done. Individuals know what they've done. And he said a better explanation is really that in 1944, when Congress made the WSLA applicable to offenses prospectively, not just to offenses that had occurred during the war, but offenses that would occur during future conflicts, they had to also remove the now indictable language to affect that change, and it really doesn't mean anything more than that. And the opinion also indicates a basic rule of legal construction, which even if it was ambiguous, since it's a suspension of a limitations period, it should be narrowly construed and interpreted in favor of repose. So it seemed to be a very simple resolution of a problem that's been kind of bedeviling the community for a while. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the Fourth Circuit's opinion. The Supreme Court didn't address this aspect of the Fourth Circuit's opinion except in passing, but the Fourth Circuit had a long discussion in its opinion about what's the triggering event to apply the wartime statute of limitations suspension. And the Supreme Court kind of brushed this discussion aside by saying, since we've decided it only applies in the criminal context but not in the civil context, we don't really need to talk about the triggering event or when the United States is at war. But there's such a good discussion of that topic in the Fourth Circuit's opinion, I just wanted to talk about it for a second. The Fourth Circuit actually relied on some language in a Fifth Circuit case to talk about the WSLA having three components, a triggering clause, a suspension period, and a termination clause, and pointing out that the Supreme Court has previously held that the WSLA applies only to offenses committed after the triggering clause and obviously before the termination clause. So there's a discussion in the opinion about what triggers the wartime statute of limitations, and it was important to the Fourth Circuit whether or not the suspension period was in effect. So they looked at how the statute had developed and the fact that courts have been in disagreement for a long time as to which version of the WSLA would apply before offenses that to offenses that occurred before 2008, and also whether the prior to 2008 version of the statute required a formal declaration of war. And the Fourth Circuit concluded, after looking at a couple of things, they concluded that a formal declaration of war was not necessary because regardless of which version you applied, whether it's the 2008 version with the war powers reference or to an earlier version with a declaration of war requirement, they found the United States was at war because it was in a conflict at the time these events occurred. And the Fourth Circuit also said they believe requiring a declared war would be unduly formalistic, since we really haven't had one of those since World War II. And we've had Korea, Vietnam, Kosovo, Iraq, and other things, but no declaration of war. So the Fourth Circuit was satisfied that the suspension period was, in fact, triggered, and it didn't need all of these formalities. And they were also satisfied that at the time of this opinion, neither Congress nor the President had declared those hostilities at an end. So they viewed the statute as applicable. And they went on also to discuss the topic of whether it is whether it's criminal or civil. As I said, the Supreme Court didn't choose to take on the whether it's a wartime act or not. So just in conclusion on this first point, the defense bar, the recognition that the suspension period does not apply to civil cases is a big win from this Supreme Court decision. It means there are a lot of stale claims that won't be litigated. It means there are a lot of cases that have been underway that will no longer be underway. And in fact, I don't know if there are people on this call who listened to the oral argument, but at the oral argument, KBR's counsel was asked whether this would resolve his concerns. And he said the case was decided on this issue, would resolve KBR's concerns. So it's a big deal, but it's not the only issue the court discussed. So I'm going to turn this over to Chris to talk about the first to file bar.
Thank you, Marcia. Important to understanding the court's decision in the first-to-file bar is knowing what the implicit deal is between relators and the government. The idea is that the relator brings to the government information, and that permits the relator to A, have the government investigate it, but B, prosecute the claim, and if he recovers, he gets treble damages plus interest plus attorney's fees, and then he gets to keep a third of the damages and hands over to the rest of the government. The government implicitly says, we will let you keep a third of what we are entitled to because you've told us about this fraud, which we might not have otherwise known. The problem that arose in the pre-1944 version of the False Claims Act was that there was no knowledge requirement. What would happen was that in the Supreme Court case of United States ex rel Marcus V. Hess, a guy happened to be hanging out at the courthouse. He overheard an indictment being read regarding bid rigging on a federal contract, and he filed a claim saying, hey, they've committed a False Claims Act violation. Please give me my damages. To the government, this didn't serve the purpose. He hadn't brought anything new of which they were not already aware. And so in 1944, Congress added a provision that said, quote, unless the government proceeds with the action, the court shall dismiss an action brought by a person on discovering the action is based on evidence or information the government had when the action was brought. This amendment to the False Claims Act was clearly aimed at cases like Hess, which in the courts have universally called the parasitic cases. In 1986, as Marcia mentioned, Congress substantially loosened the False Claims Act, seeking to make it easier for relators to bring claims. And one of the things was they deleted that straight, very easy to understand government knowledge provision and added three provisions. The first one is the one that is at issue here in this case, which says, when a person brings an action under this subsection, no person, other than the federal government, may intervene or bring a related action based on the facts in the pending action. And pending is the word the Supreme Court is going to give a lot of attention to. The other two relevant jurisdictional bars are later in the statute, which says, in no event may a person bring an action which is based on allegations which are the subject of a civil suit or administrative civil money penalty proceeding in which the government is already a party. Once again, the idea is, if the government already knows about the fraud, there's no point in giving the relator a third of what the government could recover for telling the government that which it already knows. The final bar is known as the original source, because it says the court shall dismiss a claim if substantially the same allegations were already publicly disclosed in a federal criminal proceeding in which the government is an agent or party, or in a federal or congressional report, or from the news media, unless the guy telling you the stuff the government already knows and is bringing a suit under is the original source of that information. So that's the context of the deal that the government implicitly makes with relators, is you have to, generally, you have to bring them something new. The second thing to remember is the procedure under the False Claims Act. When the relator brings his lawsuit, he's got to file it under seal, and he doesn't get to do anything with it for a while. The court, the relator then serves it on the relevant AUSA in the district in which the case is filed. The AUSA then has, under the statute, 60 days, but usually extended to longer than that. As pointed out in some of the amicus briefs, it frequently extends to 2 years, to investigate it. And at the conclusion of that, the government has to say, we are either intervening, in which case the government doesn't have to, but always does, file its own complaint, or the government can say, we choose not to intervene, in which case the relator can go and bring the case himself and do discovery himself. So anytime you see a relator who's brought his own case and isn't proceeding with the Department of Justice really leading the charge, you know that the Department of Justice has already looked at the case and made the decision that it doesn't feel the need to intervene, whether it's because of merits or because of other considerations. So as Marcia mentioned, Mr. Carter had a very long road to the courthouse. Suffice it to say, he filed his claim in 06, about a year after he got back from Iraq, and things sort of puttered along. The court dismissed his claim for failure to plead fraud with particularity. He then refiled. The case that the government declined to intervene, the case then went through discovery, and then a month before trial, the DOJ hopped up and said, oh, wait, there's another pending case. Thus, this has to be dismissed under the pending case bar. This, of course, made nobody happy. The case that was pending was out in California. It was a case by the name of Thorpe. Mr. Carter appeals the dismissal. While he's appealing it, Mr. Thorpe's case is dismissed for failure to prosecute, and then he tries to refile his claim. The district court dismisses his new complaint, saying you've got a new first-to-file bar because your claim is still pending because you've got your appeal going on in the Fourth Circuit. So he then pulls his appeal and refiles his current his 2011 complaint, and then they proceed from there. At other times, we also get an action in Maryland. At another time, there's an action in Texas, which pose problems. And eventually, the court says, no, these other cases are the case in California, Thorpe, was pending when you filed it. Therefore, even though it's dismissed, you are still barred by the first-to-file bar. So he takes an appeal. Now, the Fourth Circuit had said, well, under the word pending, it has to mean that the case is active. If it's already been dismissed, that means that it's no longer pending, and therefore we can proceed from there. And this was appealed as well to the Supreme Court. In their briefs, KBR argued that pending, in the context of the language, simply is referring to which case results in the dismissal. Specifically, remember, the language was, when a person brings an action in this subsection, no person other than the government may intervene or bring a related action on the facts underlying the pending action. There is a split among the circuits. The First and D.C. Circuit had ruled that the prior dismissed action did bar later actions. The Fourth, Seventh, and Tenth Circuit had held no. The correct thing to do is to say that pending means that it's still alive, that it's still alive. And once it's no longer alive, then another relator can go and file its bar. The Supreme Court agreed with the relator and also agreed with the Fourth Circuit. It said that the interpretation does not comport with any known usage of the term pending. Under this interpretation, Marbury v. Madison is still pending, so is the trial of Socrates. One would argue whether Mr. Socrates would feel that his trial is still pending, but that's what the Supreme Court said. Justice Alito also said that KBR's interpretation pushed pending beyond the breaking point, knowing that the effect would bar all subsequent suits, even if the dismissal had nothing to do with the merit, and noted multiple interpretive issues with the FCA. Justice Alito was sympathetic to the arguments KBR made in his brief, where it said, look, if we don't interpret pending the way we say, then the problem that arises is we're going to be reluctant to settle, because you settle with a relator, you get the approval of the Department of Justice to settle the case and the approval of the court, you dismiss the action, and then all of a sudden another person could pop up. This might seem far-fetched. However, in the Fourth Circuit, this did in fact happen in May v. Purdue Pharma, where the first case was dismissed because of the settlement, and then someone came on with an extraordinarily similar case. And they said, no, first to file means you're barred, and they also made a claim preclusion argument. And the Fourth Circuit rejected both of those. Justice Alito's response to this was, one, yes, the FCA poses, as he put it, interpretive challenges to try and find resolution, but that's not the court's problem. And two, you can always rely on claim preclusion. Now, in the Purdue Pharma case, claim preclusion was exactly what the defendants had brought. Now, that got rejected. Why? Well, claim preclusion requires identity of parties, identity of actions, and a final judgment. They said, well, we've got the final judgment. See, he dismissed his case. And remember, the DOJ has to sign off on that deal as a practical matter. Second, we've got identity of parties, because the real party in interest is the United States. The relator's just making it his job to bring the United States' claim. And we have an identity of actions. The complaints were extraordinarily similar. But the Fourth Circuit in Purdue Pharma said, no. There is not an identity of parties because the relator is different. Now, that obviously poses a big problem for companies, because if you've got a claim out there and you want to settle it, you're going to be reluctant, as KBR pointed out in its briefs, to settle for the full value of the claim, because you're going to say, yes, but there's another guy who could potentially come along. There may be ways around this problem posed in Purdue Pharma. And the Fourth Circuit in Purdue Pharma expressed extreme skepticism at the relator's claim that it was merely a coincidence that the two complaints were so extraordinarily similar, but said it was a factual issue that required a full hearing. But it certainly did leave a potential issue out there for government contractors who are seeking to resolve these cases. As one final note of analysis, I think Justice Alito's opinion dealing with the pending claim issue simply ignores the fact that for purposes of pending actions, if you say, no, it wasn't pending, then you're ignoring the context of the fact that the government already knows about all the allegations that could be brought in subsequent claims and has made a decision not to intervene, not to bring it on behalf of itself. It's important to note that in Thorpe, the California case that was the original cause of the dismissal, the case was dismissed for failure to prosecute. That means not only did Mr. Thorpe think it not worth his time to continue with this case, but the Department of Justice had made its decision that this was not worth its time. Thus, I think by ignoring the identity of interest and the extensive involvement in the Department of Justice in any settlement, any litigation involving the False Claims Act, Justice Alito may have permitted government contractors to be beset by more relators than Congress intended. And with that, I'll turn it back over.
I was just going to add one thought to Chris's discussion on the first to file bar. In the opinion, Justice Alito talks about it would be really kind of unfortunate if the case was held to be still pending, and as a result, you know, the issue could never be pursued, even if it was a valid claim, or as in the case of Thorpe, if my memory's correct, Chris, the complainant had actually abandoned his claim. So I think that Justice Alito's opinion at least expresses some concern about a non-merits dismissal precluding the ability to pursue the claim. But the statute itself permits the government to pursue the claim in any event. So if they're on notice that the claim is out there, that the issue's been raised, they get the complaint, they can pursue it if they have concerns. And I think the court's opinion actually doesn't quite do the statute justice. It's like they decided the easy issue, the WSLA issue, and kind of punted on the second issue because they don't really grapple with the legislative history on the first to file bar and, you know, why you would have the statute structured the way it's structured and the burden that it really places on defendants if they have to defend repetitive claims. Because really, if you put the two pieces of the opinion together, basically you're at risk now of having repetitive claims until the statute of limitations runs out. Chris, I don't know if you want to add anything.
No, that's absolutely correct. It's the overall implicit bargain when you look at the legislative history and everything else is that the government doesn't want to pay relators a third of what just for information the government already knows. And I think by interpreting the pending claim, the first to file bar, in the way it did, the court has ignored that implicit bargain.
So, Dean, I think we're ready for questions.
Terrific. Let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got almost a full 30 minutes left. Our lines are wide open. While we're waiting to see if anybody checks in, let me make our typical commercial announcement. Next week, in terms of Teleform conference calls, we're likely to add a few depending on what the Supreme Court does. We've reserved Monday and I think Tuesday for adding Teleform conference calls that respond to Supreme Court decisions that might come down on Monday morning. So do check our Teleform webpage and monitor your emails for updates there. On Wednesday at noon is a Choose Life free speech case. That involves the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that has ruled that a Choose Life license plate in the state of New York should be stricken. That's Wednesday at noon, and that'll feature Professor Eugene Volokh. Thursday at noon, both of these are Eastern time, of course, a new book by Professor Ilya Soman, marking the 10th anniversary of the Kelo takings case. He'll be discussing that with Professor Richard Epstein, not just the Kelo takings case, but all the legislation and regulation that ensued during the backlash of the Kelo decision. But again, do check the website. Today, of course, we're talking to Christopher Bowen and Marcia Madsen about the False Claims Act and other matters. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending at this point, so let's go to our first caller.
You know what? I just decided I'm going to submit my question anonymously. So I'll just submit my question at another time.
Okay. Well, I can assure you we don't know who you are. If you'd like to,
Angela Ellison.
Okay. Well, your question anonymously, but.
Okay. Say that again. I'm sorry.
I was going to say we don't know who you are, so you could have submitted your question anonymously, but now you've given us your name, so that's not possible. If you want to send us an email, you can do that to the Federalist Society.
That'd be good. I'll send it. Thanks.
Thank you. For others on the call, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll be happy to take your questions. While we're waiting to see if others ring in, let me ask a question. It seems to me, and I'm not exactly a student of the Supreme Court, but they seem to be taking quite a few False Claims Act cases, you know, in the past several years. Every year there seems to be one or two trying to fine-tune jurisprudence under the False Claims Act. Is that, I mean, is in your views, is it because the act is so complicated? Is it poorly written? Is it difficult to file, to follow? Or is it simply that the amounts of money and the potential liabilities are so great that people are going to litigate this until the end of time?
Well, I'll go first. I think it's a combination of all of those. I think the exposure, if you're a defense contractor, is very high. You do not want to have be found to have violated the False Claims Act in a final judgment. And so the nitty-gritty of the jurisdictional in and out, the statute of limitations, is extraordinarily important. You don't, you know, if you can get rid of this by showing that the plaintiff is not an original source, can show that the plaintiff is simply a parasitical relator, and that that will just could potentially save your company. More likely, it will simply save you protracted negotiations for a settlement. I think that we have also seen an uptick in the use of the False Claims Act. We've seen it being used outside of sort of its normal bounds. You look at the False Claims Act, and your first reaction is this is about people overbilling, it's about people lying on invoices. But it's really expanded the government's use of it has really expanded beyond that. So I think you just have more litigation, and with that you have more interesting issues coming out. And then I think Justice Alito is right to note the interpretive challenges, the False Claims Act. It has been cobbled together for over a century and a half now, and some parts mesh well with the current number of bureaucracies and the different administrative proceedings you can find yourself under. Some of them don't mesh so well, and so trying to resolve that is really a challenge.
So I would add to that, I think particularly for companies that are in regulated industries where there's any sort of, in the case of government contractors, I mean, they're paid directly for the work that they do, but they're not the only ones who have benefits from the government. I mean, there are such things as reverse false claims that apply, for example, in royalties cases. The healthcare industry is affected through its participation in various federal programs, which are expanding. And the relators bar, and we're talking about the plaintiff's bar here, is using the statute aggressively to recruit potential whistleblowers. There was an article in one of the trade publications a couple of days ago, actually very recently, about whistleblowers and how they're coming forward more. They've seen the recoveries, and that's, I mean, a company with a good compliance program and a good process for dealing with its own ethical issues is essential today. I mean, the defense industry kind of led the way there, but the point of the article was that you've got a more sophisticated community and they are coming forward. And importantly, I think for companies in regulated industries, the Department of Justice, we're not going to have a conversation today about implied certification claim or issues, but Department of Justice is frequently, as are relators, using this statute to enforce various interpretations of regulatory provisions that no one would have thought of as necessarily involving fraud. And so those can be very high-stakes issues, and the law isn't at all clear in that area.
Again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone to indicate so. We can join the conversation. I understand the idea of incentivizing whistleblowers by giving them some share of the recovery. That certainly makes some sense. Has there been, that notwithstanding, has there been any serious consideration to legislatively eliminating the relator's share, or limiting recovery to cases where a relator can actually convince the government to become a party and convince the government that there is a case there. That might be some sort of standard that would prevent, I don't want to say coercive settlements, but settlements in cases that the government prosecutors have determined there's not enough merit there to involve government prosecution.
Short answer? Nope.
I mean,
would that be a good and useful fix or not?
Well, I mean, people have certainly talked about that kind of thing, but it really hasn't gotten any traction in Congress. I think there's a perception, and it's not completely an unrealistic perception that, you know, when you have folks who will bring a claim and who are not afraid to blow the whistle, that they do make a contribution. I think the question's gotten to be, where's the balance?
Mm-hmm.
And there doesn't seem to be much of a discussion of that point. I don't know, Chris, what you think.
I think the reforms you mentioned, Dean, sound very useful. Obviously, I just heard them, but you know, they certainly would do a lot to take away the parasitical claims, the strike complaints that are filed. The problem is that any time there are a few representatives who want to stand up and say we should, and this is how the media would portray it, make it easier to defraud the government. That would be the line that would be taken against them. And so it's always easier to simply say, oh, well, let's make make life more difficult for government contractors. So certainly if we could push those reforms, that would be enormously beneficial and would just make – I think contractors more comfortable dealing with the government, that especially in some areas that are currently percolating, that not every single contract breach suddenly goes from a contract claim to a false claim, Zach.
Mm-hmm. We do now have a question from the audience, so let's go to our next caller. If you'd like to join the conversation, again, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, and Ms. Madsen and Mr. Bowen for taking your time today. My question had to do a little bit more with the long wartime footing that the U.S. has been on, and considering that the Supreme Court didn't rule on what constitutes a wartime footing prior to the 2008 amendment that you mentioned. When it comes to issues of evidence and defense evidence for companies, dealing with the large difference in electronic communications from 2002 to today. Has that been something that that's come up at the other levels of this case and similar cases dealing with this particular statute?
Well, I'll jump in. I mean, it's definitely a consideration, you know, the age or staleness of some of the claims that companies have been wrestling with because of the suspension of the limitations period. Now, the court's decision for the Civil False Claims Act is making this a non-issue because they've said that the limitations period doesn't apply. So it would still be an issue for criminal defendants, but it wouldn't be an issue here unless, of course, Congress decides to make an adjustment based on the court's decision. For example, like they did after Allison Engine, they decided to change the statute. So, that's conceivable here.
I mean, you do see some decisions out there that try to grapple with just how difficult the statute makes it. Specifically, when you look at the Fourth Circuit's discussion, the Fourth Circuit basically read the 2008 amendments as superfluous. Because before 2008, it said whenever the United States is at war. After 2008, it said whenever the United States is at war, or essentially there's been an authorization for the use of military force to cover situations like we have in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the Fourth Circuit's interpretation of at war basically said anytime you have guys getting shot at in foreign lands, and that's a real problem. If you're being prosecuted criminally, you know, those cases can move very fast. You don't have all the reciprocal discovery that you get in a civil case, so they're more difficult. And there is even a case in the Fifth Circuit, I think it might have been Pfluger, it might have been another, where one of the defendants said, and remember the WSLA doesn't only apply to the False Claims Act, Criminal False Claims Act, it also applies to any number of taking a bribe or defrauding the government statutes. But the defendant pointed out, well, your interpretation being pushed by the Department of Justice would mean that claims from the first Gulf War would still potentially be viable. And the Fifth Circuit said, well, that's not before us, so we don't express any opinion, but you would hope that a court would say, no, you know, we're not going to permit stuff that is that old, and, you know, we're not going to interpret the statute that way. So that's definitely a concern for companies and for individuals who face potential criminal liability about, you know, how long that statute can take away the statute of limitations when the United States has had extensive military involvement overseas.
Thank you very much.
You're
welcome.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open once again. let me ask this as maybe a follow-up to my first question about the proliferation of FCA cases in the court. Are there other cases sort of in the pipeline, anything on the docket for next term or anything that looks, you know, maybe likely or possible to get a cert grant?
I don't know if it's going to get a cert grant. I should have mentioned this earlier, actually. There's another first-to-file case that had applied for certification. It's certiorari. I'm sorry. It's the Shea versus Selco Partnership doing business with Verizon Wireless case. It's the D.C. Circuit case that Chris was actually alluding to earlier. I think everyone's curious to see what's going to happen to that case now that the first to file issue's been resolved to the way it has in the KBR case. The Shea case involves another government contractor case where the company had a GSA schedule contract where it sold telecom services to various government agencies, and the relator sued based on a series of transactions with, as I recall, one agency. And that matter was resolved, and then he comes back, which is the source of the current case, with the same exact claim but different government agencies. So his first claim was, let's say, government agency A, same kinds of facts and arguments, but now he's talking about government agencies P, Q, and R. And the question, as it was framed by counsel for the defendants, as the question presented at the Supreme Court, was whether the False Claims Act's first-to-file bar requires dismissal with prejudice of a second-filed related action, as the D.C. Circuit held, or does it function as a one-case-at-a-time rule, allowing duplicative claims to be filed seriatim so long as no prior claim is pending at the time of filing the second suit. So if you look at what Judge Alito's opinion says, it probably resolves that question. Now, I'll be curious to see what happens with this one. It's been waiting, and I think this party actually filed an amicus in the KBR case also.
The other thing you might want to watch. I think they had filed for cert. I don't know if they've it's been granted or denied at this point. Was there has been another Fourth Circuit KB? No, it was the Triple Campy decision, and that's on the topic of implied certification, where, like I said, if you read the False Claims Act, your first thought is, oh, this applies to people who are inflating their invoices, but the implied certification is, well, we've discovered that you were breaching this regulation. And surely the government wouldn't have been paying you at all if they knew you weren't doing something that the regulation requires. Therefore, every single invoice is false. Therefore, we get to recover. It'll be interesting to see if the Supreme Court decides to take that up simply because that implied certification is an area where the plaintiff's bar has been extremely aggressive.
Very good. We do have one question now. If you'd like to ask a question, we've got about 10 minutes left. Probably have time for two more questions. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's go to our next caller.
Hi, I've got a few questions, so if you don't get another star pound, you can come back to me. The first question is, there's a statute which I've just heard about, I haven't had a chance to investigate it, saying that a bill proposed that the Defense Department wants to restrict the Freedom of Information Act, and I'm not sure of the details, but I wonder if it's a response to this decision.
I'm not familiar with the details of the bill as proposed. The intersection of FOIA and the original source requirement under the False Claims Act is very interesting. One of the, like I said earlier, mentioned in passing during my intro, one of the jurisdictional bars is that the allegations you're telling the government about couldn't have been publicly disclosed. And then they list three things: in a federal criminal or civil administrative hearing, in a congressional government accountability office or other federal report, hearing, audit, or investigation from the news media, unless the action is brought by the Attorney General or the person bringing the action is an original source. There has been litigation where I believe relators have lost, but I can't recall it perfectly off the top of my head, where they discovered the information through a FOIA, and the government said no, or the court said no, when the guys were going through pulling the files to get them to you, that constituted a report, a hearing, audit under 4A(2), and therefore you are not an original source of the information. It was publicly disclosed, and you're not the original source of that information. But again, I'm not familiar with the DOD proposed bill regarding restricting FOIA, so I can't speak specifically to that.
We don't have any further questions at this point, caller, if you want to go ahead with your other questions.
Well, I guess a follow-up question was, is that in all the circuits, or is there any conflict on that decision?
I think there's been some controversy about the FOIA rulings, but my recollection is the same as Chris's, that it's essentially along the lines of if all you did was request the information and get it, you're not an original source.
It's interesting because if you don't ask the right questions, you're never going to get that. And the fact that somebody had the right questions to ask, this is an interesting thing. What about the risk to whistleblowers of espionage charges that this administration has been so enthusiastic about? They've prosecuted more whistleblowers than all the other presidents in history.
Generally, there are specific protections in the False Claims Act for whistleblowers. It's a specific section, 3730H. And so generally when it comes to espionage, I'm not really aware of any cases that deal with the intersection of that, because generally the protections against retaliation under the False Claims Act are protecting you from being retaliated against by the contractor.
Not the government.
Not the government. So I don't think that there's much intersection there.
So anybody who comes up with something, say, from within the government, or are government employees not eligible for this?
Yep. Well, they're eligible, but typically the complaints that if you'll see, and they're unusual, but you'll see, and there's litigation about to the extent to which they're eligible, they're typically not complaining about government issues. They're typically, they'll say they saw a contractor do something, or that there's a, you know, this fraudulent payment or something like that. It's not, you know, my government employer did something to me.
Right. Okay. So, how often do cases like that get brought by government employees?
I would say it's not the majority of them.
It's not common.
It's not common. I would say that the most common one is your typical outside the healthcare context, which is its own thing, but the most common ones you see is the disgruntled contractor employer, the employee who got laid off or thinks he's not being treated correctly. And then he brings a claim saying, look, you know, you laid me off. Now I'm going to tell everyone what you were up to. That's the more common relator that you'll see. It's uncommon for a government employee to be the relator.
And there are some restrictions on government employees as well. For example, if you're an employee of the Inspector General, you can't use your position to find False Claims Act cases.
Is this basically a KTOM provision where you don't need any damages to yourself to get a reward for bringing this case?
Yeah. It is a KTAM provision.
Yep.
Yeah. And another comment I had, you might want to comment about it. It seems to me that for a lot of people, retirement may be a precondition to making one of these reports, because your career is going to be ended. No other contractor is ever going to hire you once it's known that this is what you do.
Well, within the company, if you're still with the company, companies have to be very cautious. You know, they definitely cannot be doing something that smacks of retaliation, because then, you know, you're just increasing the damages you're going to have to pay out. So within the companies have a statutory obligation not to retaliate against someone who's been a relator. Now, are there companies which may violate that provision of the law? I'm sure there are, but generally companies, government contractors, have to have loads of compliance programs, especially in the defense sphere. And so they're pretty by the book, making sure that if they're taking an adverse employment action against an employee, it's for something that is not retaliatory. As far as if you've left the employer, does that have any does that have any impact on your career prospects? I'm not sure. I'm just not sure to what extent people have experienced difficulty finding reemployment within the government contract world after they have had a relator case become unsealed.
And if I want to keep my identity anonymous, I shouldn't give my name at this point.
Well, I certainly have no idea who you are, so you're safe with me.
That's all I've got. So I guess
okay,
you want to sum up, probably.
Thank you. I think we're just about out of our budgeted time here. Let me give each of you, Marcia Madsen and Christopher Bowen, a minute to wrap up as we begin to adjourn here. Any final thoughts?
I'll jump in. We appreciate everybody listening. I think the False Claims Act for the Federalist Society is a very interesting topic because of its use as a regulatory enforcement mechanism, and we actually hope to have more of these discussions.
I echo what Marcia said and just say that although the opinion is extraordinarily good for the defense bar, because, you know, it does limit the WSLA to the criminal sphere, there is the Supreme Court's statement on the first-to-file bar, and because the vast majority of False Claims Act cases are civil rather than criminal, what the Supreme Court has said there will have a continuing impact, and we'll likely see more cases coming out about that.
Very good. I read it the same way. The court's closing comments from its opinion read as follows. The False Claims Act KTAM provisions present many interpretive challenges, and it is beyond our ability in this case to make them operate together like a finely tuned machine. So it does sound like there's more to come, quite a bit more to come from the Supreme Court on this. And we would welcome you back, both of you, to revisit the issues of the False Claims Act in the future going forward. So today, though, my thanks to Christopher Bowen and Marcia Madsen. This has been a very entertaining and interesting presentation for some pretty complicated issues. Certainly thank you both for your time. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to check the Federalist Society's website and monitor your emails for upcoming Teleform conference calls. But until that next call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.